Well, if you do, it'll be kind of like a doo-doo.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to today's Ask the Attorney Social Security teleconference. At this time, all parties are in listen-only mode. After the presentation, a question-and-answer session will be conducted at the moderator's discretion. At that time, if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please press 7 on your touch-tone keypad. I would now like to turn the conference over to Alicia Barron.
Welcome, everybody, and thank you so much for joining our program today, Ask the Attorney Social Security. I'm thrilled to have Victor McCreese with us, who is an attorney that's been in business since 1978, right? Am I right with that?
That's right. Okay. License is starting
from the okay. Sorry, I apologize. So for 32 years now, he's been in business, and we're so happy to have him because he's extremely knowledgeable about Social Security, and I think he'll be able to answer all of your questions and give you lots of really important information. So thank you once again, and then here you go, Mr. McCreese.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I'd like to acknowledge all the folks that are with me here in the room, as well as all the people that are listening on the phone, and we're going to try to accommodate everybody today in both spheres of listening. As we're going along, I'm going to be talking about a PowerPoint that I have going. Apparently my PowerPoint was so large that I couldn't email it, so otherwise we would have put it on the website so that people could see it, but that's why it's not on there. But I'm going to be tracking the PowerPoint pretty closely, and so I'll take the folks that aren't going to miss a thing by the time we're done. So by the same token, I'm going to ask if we could, because we have a telephone audience and a present audience, to hold the questions until the end if we can, and then have plenty of time for questions at that point. Well, again, as Alicia said, my name is Victor McCreese. I was born in Houston, and if you want to just go ahead and go to the next slide, born in Houston, it's going to be the arrow. There we go. I was born here in a hospital that no longer exists downtown. It was the St. Joseph's Maternity Ward, which is a beautiful Art Deco building. They tore it down. There's a fountain there now. I don't know why they did that, but anyway, I was drive by there and look at it. It's kind of interesting. I was a congressional intern in college, which really gave me my first exposure to doing this kind of work. We got a lot of calls from people that, you know, were having heart transplants and things like that, that couldn't manage to get their Social Security disability. And even then, when I was in my 20s, I started wondering, why is that? Why people get a heart transplant or a liver transplant, why can't they get Social Security disability? It seemed like that would be automatic. And it really hit home when Reagan was talking to the first mechanical heart recipient. I forget his name. His name is Barney something. And he was in the hospital, and, of course, it was a famous situation, a very noteworthy situation, because it was a robot heart, first implantation of it. So here's President Reagan speaking to this guy, and he's in his hospital bed, and after a 15-20-minute conversation, which, of course, is being broadcasted on TV, Reagan finally, in his big-hearted way, says, is there anything I can do for you? You're a hero for doing this and allowing yourself to get. Is there anything I can do for you? He says, well, I could use some help getting my Social Security. So anyway, the very next day, of course, he had applied, probably had denied, God only knows what, and so the next day, Social Security sent a representative down there, a very high-level representative down there, with a check, with a check and a cameraman to record the whole thing. So that got taken care of quick. So the party started saying, okay, well, if Reagan could do that, maybe a lawyer could do some of that too. So anyway, that's why I first kind of got interested in something like that. So, but frequently I was calling Social Security and asking questions. What is it? That's what's the holdup on this case and things like that. Anyway, I ultimately went to law school, graduated in 77. I started practice in my own firm in 1978, and eventually, don't ask me how, but through a very kind of circuitous path, became board certified in personal injury trauma, which is also of which disability law is a subset of that. And we also, our firm handles, we have two other lawyers as well. We handle the traditional areas of personal injury, family law, bankruptcy, probate, criminal defense, and other matters. So if you want to go to the next slide, and when I'm not in the office, I'm doing things like this. This is a picture taken by my son Stuart when we were in Yosemite on the top of the dome, not the big dome, but one of the domes. And of course, there's all volcanic rock here. And I think I'm trying to make the picture shows me on the phone, probably trying to make a reservation for that room that night, because we both wanted to take very hot showers and have a nice bed.
You're on Social Security.
That's right, it could be too. Probably making a couple of calls to Social Security as well. So I have the next slide done. And Social Security, does anybody know for a McCreese Law Firm clock? I'm not going to be able to help out the telephone audience with this, but for a McCreese Law Firm clock, who first coined the term Social Security, was first used by? Anybody know? FDR? No. Do we know?
Herbert Hoover?
Herbert Hoover? No. One more guess. Take a guess. No? Next slide. Winston Churchill, describing the British system. I want to give the Good Try Award over here. I'm sure you want to help me on, give those folks a McCreese Law Firm clock. Alicia's going to get one too, so don't feel left out. All right. And so we can go to the next slide. And the origins of the United States system, kind of digging back, Bismarck was the one that gave us the H-65. Of course, Otto von Bismarck was one of the chief executives of the Weimar Republic, or I probably got the wrong country, or probably Austria. But in 1930, he asked the doctors, he says, what is the age that people are living to, particularly men who are the main breadwinners at that time? And he says, men are living to about the age 65. You know, they're pretty much, you know, at this day and age, that's what the lifespan is. And he says, fine, we'll make the age of retirement 65. And so you can see that the idea was very few people were presumed to going to be living that long to get Social Security. But if they did, this social insurance program would be there as a safety net in case they were not able to work, did not want to work any further. So Social Security gave us the law. They passed it in 1935. So most recently, it itself turned 65. And 65 years have already passed. So I think that happened in the year 2000. And as we know it today, it's in the form of pay-as-you-go social insurance. You're paying it as you're working, and when you need it, that's under certain conditions that we're about to get into, that's when it'll start kicking in for you. And these are in the form of retirement benefits. When one retires, traditionally at 65, I think my age of full retirement is going to be 66. They just upped it. I'm going to go ahead and say this. I'm 57, so it's going to happen at 66 for me. Survivor benefits. If an adult dies that has children, minor children, then the survivor gets to receive benefits, as does the surviving spouse. Disability benefits that we're going to be honing on today. If somebody becomes disabled along the way, they can get disability benefits. And also bundled together with the retirement benefits and the disability benefits is the Medicare that comes along with that. Now, there is also another form of disability, which is called SSI. If somebody becomes disabled and they don't have enough credits of coverage under Social Security disability, I'm going to explain what that is also, then they can get SSI, which is basically for the folks that just didn't have enough credits at that point to get Social Security disability. Bundled together with the SSI is Medicaid. Okay, now, this is an important distinction. First of all, I want to talk about what happens, what does it mean if you don't have enough credits. Well, traditionally, to get to be insured for Social Security, you have to have at least 40 work credits. You earn one work credit for every 3 months that you worked in which you made at least about $1,000. So if you make $1,000 from January through March, you just got one work credit. You need to get 40 of those. Okay, so that's about 10 years of work. Doesn't have to be sequentially. It can be off and on. But as long as you make $1,000 in any 3 month period, you just got a work credit. So most folks I see in the room, as well as myself, probably everybody here, if you work 10 years in your lifetime, I started working when I was 16. I probably was insured by the time I was in my mid-20s already. So most of us are probably insured. Now, for those people who are not for whatever reason, that's what the SSI Medicaid is for. And there's an important distinction also. There are some people who will qualify for SSI under certain circumstances. As a matter of fact, when we file applications, we're generally filing an SSI application, and if they qualify financially for the SSI program, we'll also file for SSI, and there's a reason for that. And that is, if by any chance Social Security decides, well, we made a mistake and this person really is not covered for Social Security because they didn't have enough credits, or for whatever reason we didn't get their W-2s or whatever, then the SSI application is there just in case. The other reason is because a lot of people will like to get the Medicaid instead of the Medicare. I'll never forget, I had one case where for some reason their Social Security disability application didn't get processed. And after the fact, I called them and I said, you've won your case, you're getting SSI, but I noticed here that for some reason they didn't take any action on your Social Security disability case. And he said, oh, no, that's fine, just leave it like it is. And I said, well, you're going to get more money. Your check is higher if it's Social Security. If you don't want to call down there and get them to process. And he said, no, leave it just like it is. It's because I need Medicaid. I said, really, why do you need, you're going to get Medicare on the other one, why do you need Medicaid? He said, because Medicaid pays for outpatient medications. Medicaid pays for long-term care. Medicaid pays for yada, yada, yada. He told me 10 different things that Medicaid pays for that Medicare does not, unless you get the Part B and the Part D and then the rest of it. So he said, Ms. McCreese, he said, leave it alone. Don't let sleeping dogs lie. So I said, okay. I said, I'll tell you what, you send me a little fax to that extent, and I'll close your file, and that's it, we'll be done. He said, I'll do that. So that was it. So we'll do the next slide. So that's that. There's an important then distinction between SSD and SSI, and there's also an important distinction between Medicare and Medicaid. That's the main thing, just to hold that in your mind. Okay. How are benefits paid? We pay for the social insurance through FICA. That's the withholdings they make from our check. Everybody's seen that FICA on that check, and you wonder, what is that? That's what it is, paying for the Social Security. And that's in the form of the payroll taxes. And then the FICA goes into this so-called Social Security Trust Fund. Mental footnote here. Social Security Trust Fund, what is that? Well, it's a fund. It's a huge fund, and it's got a ton of cash coming into it every single day, every single year. It's a ton of cash. I mean, imagine. We're going to get into it here in a second, but 7.5% of your paycheck, and it's matched 7.5% by the employer's operating account, you know, their fund, 15% on every, you know, man, woman, and child that's working in this country. That is a ton of cash, a huge amount of cash. And up until the economy did what it sputtered out, a few months ago, a couple of years ago, up until that time that happened, Social Security was getting way more money and what it was paying out. And so you heard about this surplus. Okay, yeah, we're building up a huge surplus in there. But, of course, that surplus, as we see in a second, will start getting capped on at a certain point. We're going to talk about that. And the other thing is that the Social Security Trust Fund, when hard cash, I mean hard Yankee dollar cash is being put in there, how is it being invested? I'm going to call the folks over here in the room. How is that money being invested? Now, the government doesn't want to just have cash in there because cash is dead money, right? It's not making any return. So anybody know what they're investing in? Bonds, there you go. United States Treasury bonds that pay typically 2-4% depending on what the market is. Okay. Well, what is that? What is a bond? It's an IOU. So they're taking the hard cash out and they're putting IOUs in, and of course it adds to the national debt, which we're going to talk about in a little bit as well. But anyway, that's some consternation there, because at the time when it comes to fund these projects, when it is time to start taking money out and fund some things, there's going to be those IOUs in there, and somebody's going to have to make good on those IOUs together with the IOUs to China and IOUs to everybody else in the world who's buying these. So that's kind of a thing. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. Next slide, please. So does anybody think here that we're paying too much income tax? Anybody think that?
Yeah.
You think that? I think that. I mean, I don't even like to think of it. Every time I think about how much income tax I paid, I feel like I'm broke. I mean, I feel really bad. So, yeah, income tax here is high, but guess what? Payroll tax is even higher. Let's look at this. 150 million United States workers pay an average income tax. In 2003, the average of what people paid in income tax was 7.3%. Okay, in 1955, the average income tax was only 3.4% for the average Joe. Okay, now the average payroll tax, though, in 2003 is 15%. That's the combined. That's the 7.5 on the side of the employee and a 7.5% on the part of the employer. In 1955, that was 5.6%. So the payroll tax between 55 and 2003 has tripled. the income tax between 1955 and 2003 has only about doubled. Okay, so the rate of increase is much higher. Next slide. So the great equalizer is the payroll tax, as we'll see here. For a family of four with a $55,000 income, the tax is $8,000 with the employer match. Okay. So 10% of taxpayers who make over $100,000 pay 64% of the income tax, okay? The ones making over $100,000 pay 64% of the income tax, okay? But they only, but they pay 31% of the payroll tax, okay? Now, the 62% of the taxpayers who make less than $50,000, they only pay 7% of the income tax, so they're only paying, you know, one-eighth less than the folks making over $100,000 in income tax, but they're actually paying about the same in payroll tax, dollar for dollar. So the payroll tax is a great equalizer. Everybody pays the same thing. It's because that's not, it's not regressive, you know, like the income tax, or, yeah, regressive like the income taxes. Next slide. So after all is said and done, if they take out all your money, how long does it take for you to get your money back? Well, in 1980, United States retiree, it took 3 years to get your money back, all your money back, and then after that, you're making a profit, okay? It's actually getting more than what you paid in. By 2003, now it takes about 15 years. You paid so much money in, it takes you 15 years to get your money back, which affects the decision whether to start early retirement. It kind of starts making early retirement look a little bit better, despite the 20% haircut that one gets. Yeah, when they early retire. Next one. Okay. Well, I heard a beep. Okay. Is it good? Okay. All right. So, who does Social Security help? Okay. How does Social Security help people with family disabilities and their families? This is going to be the big picture. Next slide. And the current design is, once you're eligible, beneficiaries have a set monthly payment coming in, which is a cost adjusted for inflation. This year, for the first time in a long time, there's no cost of living increase, which is kind of a shocker, because, you know, there, the interesting thing about it is there's actually called this senior citizen index. The senior citizen index always goes up. The people that are over, you know, 55, 60, 65, 70, their costs go up, even if you know, everybody else's costs done according to whatever they factor into this giant formula. And but their costs go up in different things, mostly medical care and things like that, and medications and so on. But the beauty of the Social Security program is that one can move in and out of the different programs. There's the main three programs, retirement, survivors, and disability. There are many people who will move in and out of the different ones just depending on what's going on in their lives at the time. And it depends on work history, age, eligibility. And the same benefit formula, though, in terms of the check that's coming in, applies to all programs. So next. And we're looking at the next slide here. And it's so way to think about it is it's a manner of having a social and family insurance. All workers share the risk of the same common life events. Each worker's record provides benefits for different generations of family, even young workers. Even young workers can get it. And it's a guaranteed monthly payment. And I want to say something about it. The reason I put this up here is that there came a time when I was in my 30s or so, and my folks were approaching you know, their 60s and so on. My father became ill. And at that point, I had a couple of kids, one of whom is in the room here helping me out today. And, you know, it weighed on my mind very heavily, you know, that here I have these young children I'm trying to raise, I'm trying to pay the bills, I'm knocking myself out at work, et cetera, and then I got my folks that I'm trying to take care of. And it was not until I realized, oh, wait a minute, we're within 3 or 4 years of Social Security, okay, that we'll at least have a check coming in. Medicare would be covered, and if, you know, the basic lights and food and, you know, some basic things were covered, and they had medical care on top of it, I knew that was 70 to 80% of my burden as the oldest son was going to be help a lot. And so I think the biggest breath of fresh air and sigh of relief I've ever breathed in my life is when I had that realization. So all I can say is I'm glad it was there. I'm glad it was there. A lot of our clients say the same thing in their situation. So And it gives essential protection for millions of families that face a disability. Adults with very serious disabilities have a very low employment rate because of what they may have. And, of course, families of workers who become disabled need a guaranteed deed income as well. Okay, next slide. Now, what is the value? Just kind of get an interesting idea here. The value of a Social Security coverage. Let's say if one was going to go out and buy a life insurance policy that would pay the family X amount of dollars per month until, for their lives, as long as they needed it. Or a disability policy of the same amount. If the life insurance policy that would take care of your minors and your children and your spouse until your kids became 18, or a disability policy that would pay you disability income until you reach the age of full retirement, et cetera. That would be for a life insurance policy to go out and buy that in the open market, it would cost $403,000. For a disability policy, that would cost $353,000. So you can see that paying that 7.5%, although it seems kind of high and everything, it's really, considering what the alternative would be, it's really quite good. That's okay. How to earn insurance, basically, it's like we were saying before, every time you work 3 months at a time. Every time you make at least $1,000 in a three-month quarter, you earn a credit of Social Security. You have to have to be covered for Social Security. You have to have at least 40 work credits. However, younger workers who may have started working, say, when they were 16 and now they're 23, 24, and they become disabled or they die and they leave children, they're going to be covered anyway because they're on a faster track. The younger one is, the less credits one needs because they kind of factor that in. Next slide. So it's not just retired workers then, we're kind of funneling down now into the disability products, so it's not just retired workers then that get a Social Security check. There's over one-third of recipients who receive benefit payments, and that's about 17 million non-retirees who are getting one kind of check or another. Next slide. To recap then, a Social Security insurance basically is, it's a retirement benefit that insures retirees in their 60s after they retire from work. Number two, it's survivors that insures dependents when either the worker dies or retires. And number three, it insures a worker who becomes disabled against the loss of ability to work due to disability, as the recap. The next slide. Okay, retirement insurance. To qualify for that, retirees with disabilities when they reach the normal retirement age, it then converts to their retirement benefits at that point. And I'll never forget my uncle Johnny came to see me when he's now deceased. He came to see me when he was in his 60 or 61, and he says, I've got emphysema, I've got this, I've got that. And he says, really getting really difficult for me to work. And he worked hard all his life. He was a master at operating small businesses. If the business was 8, 9, 10, 12, 15 people, he was a master, and everybody loved him. Everybody loved him. He was a master of that. I would go there on Saturdays and watch him out and help him out. And it was unbelievable how he ran this place. Anyway, he worked very hard, stand-up work, as stand-up manager. And so finally, when he was 60, 61, he was a smoker, which didn't help. And he got emphysema and all this other stuff. And he was, like, gasping for breath most of the time. And he says, but I don't want to file at age 62 because I'm going to get a 20% haircut. And I said, okay, well, let's go ahead and file for disability for you, and that will then bridge the gap. So that way you can, when you're 65, 66, you can then file for full retirement at that point. So that's what we did. spouses are covered if the worker dies and they leave a surviving spouse, and the surviving spouse does not have enough coverage on their own. They, between age 52 and 59, if they become disabled, they can file on the deceased spouse's account, even though they themselves did not have it. Of course, when they turn 60, they can get widow or widower's benefits automatically when they're 60. So it's to bridge the gap between 52 and 59 if they become disabled in that zone of their life. Disabled adult children, if one is a Social Security recipient already themselves and they have an adult disabled child who becomes disabled before they're age 22, that adult disabled child can also receive benefits too. Workers with uneven wages due to poor health. In other words, there are some workers who just can't be fully employed. There's this concept in economics called full employment and not full employment. That's when somebody's not employed because they have an illness that they can't be fully employed. There's a program for that as well. Also, there are also covers parents of children who have disabilities. If a parent was dependent for more than 50% of their income on a child who has a disability, there's a program that accommodates for that too. Survivor's insurance. It covers if a parent dies or becomes disabled. It's going to help the minor children. Even the children will get an auxiliary pay if the worker becomes disabled. And of course, the worker will be getting their check too. Spouses of deceased workers and retirees will receive parents' benefits if they have a minor child. And disabled widowers, is what we said before, once they become age 52 to 59, they can file for disability even though they themselves were not covered. Disabled adult children recover that if they become disabled before age 22, as long as they have a parent who is a Social Security recipient at the time as well. And for young families, the monthly life insurance can kick in even when a worker dies at a young age, like we talked about before. It's they don't have to have exactly 40 credits if they died at a young age. Disability insurance. We kind of covered this already, but it basically covers disabled workers. Their children will get an auxiliary pay, and their spouse will get a bump, an extra bump if they are married. They get a bump in their pay because they are married if they become disabled. We already covered about the disabled adult children and the qualifying more faster if one is younger. People with disabilities may receive all three types of Social Security benefits, just depending on what the situation is. Family members are also eligible, and disabled adult children often move between programs as well. Advantages of age and getting disability is something we were talking about a little bit before we started, and the regulations are definitely friendlier to disability applicants age 55 and over. Now, I don't want anybody listening to this to think that they couldn't get disability if they're under 55. All I'm saying is that at 50, the regulations start getting just more friendlier towards a finding of disability. It's easier. At 55, you're in warp drive after that. You know, between 55 and 60, it's growing. Those regulations are then bent even more towards allowing disability, whereas before 50, 49 and younger, and it's not quite as friendly, but it's still there. So I don't want anybody thinking just because they're X age, they can't get it. No, I've got disability for people as young as 23 or 26, just depending on what their situation is. Next slide. We talked about the disabled adult children. It's basically if a parent is disabled, retires, or dies, and their Social Security check coming in for them, they become disabled before age 22, they get it also. Next slide. Younger workers' disability, they need fewer credits. They must prove significant, if one is a younger individual, they must prove significant work limitations, and the amount that they will get as a check if they win depends on their previous earnings and how much they paid into the system. And, of course, the benefits are there even for a younger worker, for their spouse and children as well. SSD and SSI. I kind of covered this a little bit before, but how are our Social Security and SSI disability programs different? Next slide. Social Security Act, as we said, is Title II. Title II means the AIDS Survivors and Disability Insurance Program. Title 16, SSI, is technically welfare, because the main difference between the two is Title II, which is the AIDS Survivors Disability Insurance Social Security Program, is based on one's own account, based on what they paid in, based on the fact that they have an account, they're covered, they're insured, and so on and so forth. And they get Medicare, bundled along with that. Title 16, though, is the SSI/Medicaid, and that is welfare. They not only have to prove what everybody else does to get disability from the medical side, they also have to prove the non-medical criteria, which is proving that they don't have, generally speaking, more than $2,000 in assets outside of their, like, homestead asset stuff, a house of any value, car of any value, all their stuff in their house, all that doesn't count, burial policy, some essentials don't count. But once you start talking about that extra rent house, once you start talking about that yacht that's docked in Galveston Bay, Once you start talking about, you know, the condo in Colorado or something like that, then we start getting into some problems, okay? Also, from an income standpoint, you know, it once, you know, for a person that has a couple of dependents, that person might be able to make, you know, $1,000, $1,100 or so and still qualify. If one is single and just on their own, they may be able to make $700, $800 without being disqualified. But I guess what I'm saying is for the Title 16, the main distinction between the two is the Title II is insurance-based, pay-as-you-go. You could be worth $40 million, and I know somebody who's worth $40 million who's getting an SSD check as we speak. I guess probably other things to say about that. And then the Title 16 is welfare-based. Okay, you can't be worth $40 million. You can't be worth anywhere near it to get the Title 16 because that is welfare-based. Next slide. So, the main difference in the program in terms of funding is that Title II is funded with, that's the account-based program, is funded with payroll taxes. That's workers who are working, and it covers their beneficiary, spouses, and children, and you get Medicare with that. Title 16 is the welfare-based that we talked about, the SSI, and that is paid for from general revenues from the federal budget, and it covers also aged and blind, disabled adults and children, just like the disability program does. It's needs-based, which means there is this financial criterion we were talking about, and also Medicaid then comes bundled with that instead of Medicare. Okay, and it's possible to receive different benefits. One may get Social Security disability and SSI at the same time, and let me explain how that could happen. Let's say, for example, that because of the amount that one paid in, and let's say they're making minimum wage and so on, their check may only be $400 or $500 a month on Social Security disability. But if they also have an SSI application, they can pick up an extra $174 because SSI pays $674. And so if their Social Security disability check, if their insurance based check is only $500, then they can pick up that extra $174 on the SSI application. Okay, so the SSD benefit always acts as an offset against whatever SSI benefit that there is. Another thing is they may get one benefit now and another one later. Beneficiaries may work, okay, but how much they can work is different for each program, but I will say generally this, that once one starts making over $800 or $900 a month, then it becomes extremely problematic. Currently, SGA is defined for the Social Security Disability Program as about $1,000 per month, but that also raises other questions. You can stay under $1,000 and still be legally okay, but then they start looking at you harder. They start saying, okay, if you can make $900, if you can make $1,000, why can't you make more? And then they have a little bit of, like they do, have a little bit more explaining to do, you know, so. Okay, but some people have to earn their insurance, to keep their insurance and things like that. And a very good, incidentally, just mental footnote, a very good response to that is that if you have a job where the employer will let you show up if you have a good day, if you have a job where you cannot be fired, if your employer will let you lay down if you need to and take a break and then get back up again, I have a job like that. I mean, not my own job, but I have a job in the office like that. It's a person who scans records in. You know, we have, you know, any number of records that need to be scanned from time to time when their file is closed. And I tell those folks, they're typically college students, and I say, you know something? As long as that scanner is humming, you can do anything you want. You can talk to your friends. You can text your friends. You can watch TV. You can study. Most of them are studying. That's what they're doing. They're studying. And so they just keep that hopper full, and that thing keeps going. And as long as that hopper's full, they can do anything that they want. They want to lay down. They want to show up in their shorts. I mean, I don't care, you know. And so there's that kind of job is out there. And if they have to miss a day because they have an exam, okay, that's fine. You know, as long as there's a steady flow going on, that's okay. So there are jobs like that, okay. And so if it's that kind of job where it's almost impossible to be fired, you can do anything you want. You lay down, not show up, and that kind of thing, that helps a lot. So I hope I kind of described that a little bit. All right, paying current benefits. It's a pay-as-you-go system. Most money coming in pays for current beneficiaries, but there is a surplus that builds up that has been building up over time, again, until the economy starts sputtering. And the good thing about the program is it's very low administrative costs. They tend to administer it quite efficiently. Okay. What are the trust funds? Basically, there's two trust funds. One is old age and survivors insurance disability benefits. And that takes care of people with disabilities get benefits. One is the old age and survivors insurance trust fund. The other one is for disability insurance. So they kind of divide it up like that. People with disabilities get benefits from both funds. But the policymakers generally speak about it as one fund. Okay, but I just wanted to make that distinction. There's actually two, but they kind of talk about it as if it's one. Okay. And what is the big concern? You know, there was a former president, I'm going to name him a little bit later, but a former president was going around the country saying, Social Security is broke. Social Security is broke. You know, and for a policymaker, for a chief executive of a company to go around saying their company's broke, their stock is going to get trashed really quick. If their stock is trading at $50, it's not going to be soon if they go around talking, president goes around talking about that the company's broke, that stock's going to be down to $2 or $3 really quick, even though the asset value, the book value, may be 45 and it's trading at 50, that stock's going to go down to 2 because the president's gone around trashing the company, right? It's not going to last long. Well, anyway, question is there going to be enough money to pay future old age survivors disability insurance benefits? Okay. Well, to me, solvency means the ability to pay legal obligations as they become due. That's what solvency means to me. As long as you got the cash, you know, you got your bills you got to pay, you got your minimum payment on your credit cards, you got your light bill, you got your monthly mortgage payment, you got all these things. As long as you have enough money to do all that and have maybe a little bit of surplus over here for a rainy day, your brakes fail or whatever, you need to have a brake job or whatever, you have a little bit of money saved aside to do that, you're solvent. Okay, you're not doing bankruptcy or anything. It's not an issue for supplemental security income because that's paid out of just general revenues. Okay, we can go to the next one. But a developing concern is, of course, where the money comes in from for the trust funds. What happens to the money? Well, another concern is, of course, that, as we said a while ago, that an IOU is being put into the account when they take the cash out with this huge amount that's coming in to the Treasury. To invest that money, treasury bills are going in that to give it a little bit of interest. And there's a concern, of course, that when in the future, who's gonna make that payment when the time comes and put that money and pay that money back in? But that's another question. But if we can move on here, is Social Security currently broke? Well, under the definition of being able to pay for the obligations that are due at this point, the answer is no. It's not broke. It's, as a matter of fact, again, before as we said a while ago, before the economy started sputtering, it was bringing in way more money than it was spending, than it goes out every year, and building up a surplus. But media and government officials alike have been calling the system broke. George Bush was going around before he got distracted with 9/11 and all that, and they were trying to do a sea change, and it was private accounts. And the deal with the private accounts caused such an uproar. I mean, here we're trying to, we kind of missed the perfect opportunity to refinance or to do the bridge financing needed for Social Security because the administration at that time tried to do a sea change, you know, like the complete change of conceptual thing on how we regard these private accounts, align private investments. But I guarantee you one thing, there are people with master's degrees and PhDs and Nobel Prizes that have lost billions of dollars. I don't even want to talk about the thousands of dollars I have lost on the stock market. I mean, it's not even funny, you know. But what I'm saying is that if we put Social Security money into the hands of private folks to invest, some of them are going to do very, very well. They're brilliant. They know what to do. They're savvy and all that. But most of us don't have a clue, including Nobel Prize folks. And so the problem is, when we went this path of beating the drum of saying the system was broke, private accounts, that became a major distraction from doing the job of basically tweaking the engine. If the engine doesn't start, you don't take the engine out and throw it out and put a new engine in, which, you know, you have a hybrid engine in, okay? You tweak it. You change the spark plugs. You put a new battery in. You tweak it. And there's some tweaking that could have been done at that point while we were kind of together, of course, before we got distracted overseas and everything like that. But unfortunately, it was approached from an idealistic standpoint instead of a let's roll our sleeves up and just look at the mechanics of it and just get it done type of approach. So anyway, no, but there is a shortfall. Right? Now, the only question is when the shortfall occurs, and that depends on who you talk to. If you talk to the Congressional Budget Office, they tell you one thing. If you talk to some economists at a think tank, they'll tell you something else. But generally speaking, there's a predicted shortfall in the amount of money that would be coming in versus the amount that needs to go out. And this year, the year that that happens, where you reach a parity between what's coming in and what's going out, or even a shortfall in the amount of what's coming in as opposed to what needs to go out, it depends on who you're talking to. The next slide is that the Congressional Budget Office, the last time I checked, and it just changes from time to time, say that full benefits can be paid using payroll tax income until 2020. Now, some people are trying to say, well, it's now in the teens. It's now 2016, 2017, the teens something. But as the last time the CBO, I think, spoke on it is around 2020 or so, which means that it can pay full benefits using what's coming in on payroll tax income and redeeming the trust fund bonds. Then they can use the surplus that has built up all these years, drawing on it, to do this bridge financing between 2020 and 2052. Now, the year 2020 starts, like I said, starts getting pushed earlier, and the year 2052 starts getting pushed earlier, depending on who you talk about. But that's generally speaking that there's 32 years of surplus built up, maybe, you know, somewhere between 20 to 30 years, depending on who you talk to, before there's a shortfall. Now, next slide. The question is, what is the fix? Okay, what is the fix? Well, before we start talking about private accounts and started getting distracted on trashing the current system and revamping it, the proposals were increasing payroll taxes, of course. Also, which not only is increasing the percentage, but also increasing the amount that that salary is exposed to. Currently, it's about $108,000 that payroll tax can be paid on, but they're thinking now of just letting that roll up to the full amount that one is making. So if somebody's making $250,000 a year, it would apply to the whole $250,000 instead of just the first $108,000. Then they take care of some of it right there. Raising the current retirement age. Right now, I'll start getting a check at 66, but you know they may boost that up to 67, for example. They could reduce the monthly benefits or control the COLA increases. They could inject more money in from the Treasury. There's any number of things that can be done, but probably no one thing is going to do it. It's going to take a combination of things to bridge, again, to bridge that gap from now, start putting that in so that the money is there when it has to be drawn on. Next one. Now, the basic test, finally, I know you all have been waiting for this. And incidentally, before we leave that point of the shortfall, anybody want to? Yes, I've already given you clocks, so I don't have another prize here. But can anybody tell me what, in other words, if there was not a penny to cover the shortfall, what the worst shortfall predicted is at this point? Anybody know? In other words, if in the year 2052, when the surplus finally peters out, or 2050, 2049, whatever they want to say, what is the shortfall in the amount that can be paid out versus what is coming in? Anybody have a clue? Okay, 79%. In other words, at that point, 79% of the benefits will still be paid. But it's the 21% that they're looking at to how they're going to finance. That's what it is. So that's what this whole crisis is over. Really, before we leave this point, the worst crisis is on Medicare. The Medicare is one that's going to be out of control because those costs are going up 20% a year. That's what this whole ruckus is about now, you know, because the medical costs are just rising 20% per year. And incidentally, you know, we had tort reform in 1993 here when George Bush was the governor. Have y'all seen y'all's medical costs go down since we had tort reform here? I haven't seen it. I haven't seen a bit, not a penny. Okay, not a penny went down. But there was like a major medical tort reform in the state of Texas in 1993, 1994. As far as I'm concerned, it didn't even dent it. That money went somewhere else. All right, so basic test for getting Social Security disability. You must have a mental or physical impairment. See, most people think you have to be the walking dead or something. That's not true. One can have a combination of a physical and mental, or a mental together with the physical. It can be one or the other or both. Lasting, which is presumed to last more than 1 year. So if somebody breaks their arm, that's a fix of about 6 to 8 weeks. You're going to have a cast on and that sort of thing. That's not going to qualify. However, as I had a 25-year-old woman who was a security guard at a store. She went after somebody who was shoplifting. The guy swung around and swung something at her. She put her arm up and her forearm was shattered, and she required a series of staged operations over the course of 2 to 3 years to restore full function of her shattered forearm. She qualified, and she was about 23, 24, 25, in that range, okay? Precluding competitive work, which that disability lasting more than 1 year will preclude competitive work in previous employment or other employment which exists in the local or regional economy. So it has to prevent one from what they did in the last 15 years, or what's considered relevant employment is that which one did in the last 15 years. And if they can't do that, is there other employment that could be done that person can still do within their residual, the residual capacity they still have despite the impairments that they have? And if the answer to that, to all that, is no, they can't do that, then they meet, next slide, they meet the definition of disability. Now, there is I'm not sure if there's a slide on this, I can't remember, but there is a state of presumptive disability as well. Even before you get into this test that I just went into a second ago, the 1 year and having the, you know, not being able to do the previous work and not being able to do any other work, which presumably is that that could be anywhere from flipping burgers all the way to being CEO of General Electric and everything in between. That competitive work, all that discussion kind of goes out the wayside if one is presumptively disabled. And in a second, I'm going to show you all a slide on what presumptive disability is, which overrides everything that was in the previous slide that I mentioned. And so when we'll get to that for MS here in a second. Now, how to prove disability? You prove disability through medical records, okay? It's very difficult if one has even something seriously wrong. They may have a combination of hepatitis and HIV and bipolar and everything all together, but they haven't been seeing the doctor. Then it's left up to Social Security to send them out for consultative exams, and, you know, those aren't always the best. And, you know, and so and if one cannot afford the treatment themselves, then even the Harris County Hospital District program, which is quite good on trauma and quite good on other things, maybe not as good as for chronic illnesses, but it's still something. It's still, they have a good, Alicia just said they have a good MS treatment. They have a good MS what?
MS clinic.
They have a very good MS clinic. Okay, excellent. And there's an MHMRA for the mental health stuff. MHMRA is excellent. They do a very good job documenting things. They take care of their folks. And so I have nothing but good things to say about MHMRA. It's basically by seeking treatment and by whatever means one can, by whatever health insurance one has, by whatever county facilities that is going to be available to them, whatever, there's free clinics also, by whatever means. There is, say, for example, for our homeless folks, there's a clinic at Lord of the Streets. There's a clinic every Tuesdays and Thursdays. So even those folks can develop a medical record as well. Okay. An example of, now let's talk about presumptive disability, which trumps the other discussion which we were talking about. We have to prove that something lasts more than 1 year, et cetera, and you're unemployable and everything. If one has a certain, if the doctor, if through the medical records, one can show that one has a certain series of criteria that constitute presumptive disability for that illness or condition, then one is presumptively disabled. I was giving the example before the talk that I have an acquaintance who acts as a vocational expert at Social Security hearings, and that acquaintance is a paraplegic. They're in a wheelchair. The minute that acquaintance wanted to decide that he didn't want to work anymore and he stopped working, he's going to be presumptively disabled because he cannot do the criteria of even sedentary work, which is the lowest exertional level one can possibly do in the workplace. And sedentary means you have to be able to stand or walk for 2 hours, and you have to be able to sit and do something for at least 6 hours. Well, he can sit and do something for 6 hours, but he sure as heck cannot do the 2 hour standing part, okay? So he's presumptively disabled the minute he decides to hang up his guns. You know, he can get it back. Okay, now, for multiple sclerosis, there is a similar formula, and that is that if one has a motor dysfunction in two extremities or more, or a visual impairment or mental impairment going on,
or muscle weakness, repetitive activity. These are all the elements then of what would constitute a presumptive disability in the MS arena. Okay, so if a presumptive disability that exists for that if these things are documented, again, where? In one's medical records, then that they may not even send you out for a consultative exam. They maybe just look at it in the records and go, okay, this tells the tale here and that's it. We're done and granted. And about 30 to 40% of the folks who apply who have well documented cases like that, they went on the first try. Okay, next one. There are four rules for getting disability. Okay. Does anybody know what the four rules are? What the four rules for getting disability are? Or even one of them? Yes, that helps, but the real rule. Okay. All right. Anybody know what that is? Okay. What's that?
Applying,
yeah, but okay, all right. That was a good try, though. Okay. The four rules are appeal, and above all, don't give up. Those are the four rules. One must keep appealing. I can't tell you how many excellent and perfect cases that people have come in with to see me, and they just didn't appeal. So I said, okay, we're just going to reapply again, ask them to reopen the old one. You didn't appeal, okay, and you should be okay. All right, so you just have to appeal. You know, just and it's not hard. It's not hard to do. You have to be consistent. And, of course, that's what the lawyer's for, to help you out to do that. Next slide. Okay, the application process, what do? We apply for benefits, and incidentally, there is a process now where one can apply online. We recommend that you apply with a lawyer because we always, of course, tell the truth on everything we do, but there's a certain manner of filling out forms, right? Everybody knows this, okay? And if you leave something out or you don't say something quite well or you don't say, you know, it's a spin you put on things that sometimes are very important, of course, staying within the absolute truth at all times. Reconsideration, if one is turned down the first time around, we put that request for reconsideration, which is we think you made a mistake here. Please take another look at it. Incidentally, here's a little bit more evidence. Here's another form indicating where you may have had a problem with it before. Here's some additional information. Please look at it again. Just to give you some time frames, the initial application takes about 60 to 90 days. The reconsideration takes about another 60 to 90 days. Then if we're denied again on request for reconsideration, then a request for hearing then is put in. And then basically the timeline between the denial of reconsideration and the hearing is now much shorter than what it was before. It used to be a long time. It used to be up to 2 to 3 years before. Now it's down to less than a year. In some cases, the entire process is less than a year, depending on which office gets it. then if one is denied a hearing, which incidentally is the highest potential place where people win their disabilities, approximately 68 to 70% of the people who make it to the hearing level win at the hearing level. And that's the highest place of award because at the initial level, at the initial application, it's only about 30 to 40%. But at the hearing level, where you actually have a human being sitting there, you're answering questions for them, you have all your evidence there, and you can state your case, that's 68, 69, 70%, which is the highest level, and that's where the advocacy comes in, where the lawyer can really help you. Then the final step is if you don't win at hearing, then the next step is appealing to the Appeals Council, which is still within the Social Security appellate body. And we have that down to a fine art as well in terms of appealing. We're going to file the appeal form together with the positional brief. We tell them, don't ask us if we want anything else. Don't ask us if we want the copy of the file or the hearing tape or anything else because we'll already take notes on it anyway. And just put it in line for decision. If you do that, that takes an average of about 3 to 4 months now. Now, the final shot is the federal court, like the federal district court. And God bless them, they reverse a substantial amount of cases. You know, they've done a good job at picking these things up, picking them apart, seeing what happened. And we don't win every time in federal court, but we win a substantial amount of it in federal court. And I'm always impressed whether we win or lose. I'm very impressed with the analysis that they do. A very, 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 very good analysis. And they really, but unfortunately, you have to have the appellate hooks, certain appellate hooks, to apply to federal court. And not every case has those appellate hooks that you can take there, you know, that has the hooks needed. But even in those cases, Most of the people were reapplying again, starting the process over again. So if you reach the end and we can't apply to federal court, if the ability to do so is still there, then we're going to go back and reapply again. Okay, so next slide. Go to the next slide. Okay. And so if you have any questions, we're at the end of the discussion. And if you have any questions, there's my phone number. There's also a 1-800 number on the – can I say it on the –
Yeah,
yes, okay. Our phone number at the office is 713-526-9966. Again, 713-526-9966. We're closed today, but we're, of course, open Monday through Friday. If anybody has any questions or anything, you can sometimes I'm in and out, but you can always ask for Chris or Terry or really anybody who answers the phone there if you want to explore things more if you want to come in for a free consult. That's available, too. And for those folks who are calling outside the Houston metro area, our toll-free number is 1-866-526-9966. It's the same number, except it's just the 866 in front of it, 1-866-526-9966. Paul, if you have any questions, and y'all have been a wonderful audience. I've been getting very good audience response today. Y'all get the visual cues. It kind of keeps me going, so I appreciate that. At this point, I'm going to yield for questions. And for the telephone audience, I'm taking a question right now from the folks here in the room, and I may have to, if for any folks who have a telephone question, I mean, I'll be turning to you in a second. I'll give you a cue about that.
I had applied for disability probably about 6 months, a year ago. And I was denied because she said I was still working. And I told her the reason why I was applying because I didn't know how much longer I would be able to work. And now I'm working 32 hours versus the 40. So how do I go about applying again? Is that through you?
Right. So the question is, if I'm understanding it, that a certain individual, if they was turned down because they were working 30 to 40 hours a week, and so they were told by Social Security that since they're working at this time, that they were denied. Now they've dropped their hours back down to about 30 hours a week, and so the question is, what would be the next approach? What would be the next thing? let's talk this back up a second. And if one is working, it's just like my acquaintance who's a vocational expert. He's presumptively disabled, but because he's working, he's automatically taken out of the definition of being disabled because he is working. So if one is working, then they can't be in the state of being, so to speak, of being disabled too. So in your case, that's what happened when you applied. You were working at the time, which then took you out of the definition, the legal definition of being disabled, even though it may be a struggle for you to do so. And it may be very difficult, it may be extremely difficult just even for you to get to work and do what you need to do at work to hang on to that job. It's by virtue of the fact that you're working as many hours as you're working, by virtue of the fact that you're earning what you're earning, and which anything over $1,000 a month is problematic, then that's why they turn you down. Now, the choices are to continue as you're doing, working, but what they're going to basically be looking at is how much you're making per month. Even though the number of hours you work is also important, they're going to be looking at, number one, whether you're meeting the threshold amount or not. If it's over $1,000, which to be substantial gainful activity, you're making over 1,000. Used to be 900 historically, but now they upped it a little bit. I still tell folks basically under 1,000 is if they're going to work is where they need to target their income, so to not raise the presumption of you being not disabled. But the choice for you would be to either continue working and shave your income down to less than 1,000, which then would not be SGA, substantial gainful activity, or to take a leave of absence, medical leave of absence, whatever other leave of absence you can, and apply, give it a shot of applying, and then if you're granted, then great. Then you'd be getting your disability check. If you're not granted, then you would have the option of returning back to work after you took this leave of absence. Hopefully, then your job would still be available. But those are the two choices really that one has.
How does it work? Because I'm working. My insurance is through my job and not through my husband's job. And that's another reason why I'm still working is because I have to take an injection every three times a week. And I'm getting that through my medical benefits on my job. So how would that work if I took a leave of absence? I mean, I still would be covered on my insurance, I'm sure. But my question is, I'm just trying to get a feel of what do I need to do. Because it's getting hard for me to work now.
If you were able to take a leave of absence and still have your insurance benefits, then that, of course, that would help you getting those injections and the treatment that you need, because you also, for the evidence as well as your own health, you need to be getting that treatment. So hopefully your employer would allow you to take a leave of absence and still have your insurance kicking in. That your insurance still there in place. That would be the best of all worlds, because then if it didn't work out, if you decided not to continue appealing and go forward and go back to work, that job would still be there, okay? And your insurance would have been there to cover your treatment while you were on your leave of absence and while you were applying. Now, by the same token, if that's not available, if the employer can say, look, I can't give you a leave of absence because I need somebody filling this desk and doing what you're doing, then the only other thing would be to terminate employment and go on COBRA, okay? And you have COBRA coverage that it was 18 months and they have extended it to 24 months now. COBRA, meaning you can maintain your insurance beyond your employment for an 18 month, which I think has now become a 24 month period. And you can, of course, you'll be without a paycheck during that time, but at least you'll have the insurance. So it takes some financial planning to say, okay, theoretically, if I was to stop working now, and theoretically, whatever they quote you, that the COBRA, you could ask them, theoretically, if I was on COBRA, if I had to quit today due to medical reasons, what would be my COBRA cost per month? Now, there is another possibility, and that is, do you have any short-term or long-term disability coverage at work?
Yeah.
Okay. You might want to look into that, because if you go on short-term disability, then you might have that insurance component along with that. So if the doctor wants to support you on a claim of short-term disability, you go off of work at that time, which means you can then file for a Social Security application, and yes, we can help you do that with one-stop shopping at the office. And then you can be getting your, and I think many policies, when you go on short-term disability, they pay your insurance for you at that point, your health insurance, but you have to check your particular plan.
Mm-hmm.
So it might even be better at that point, because then you don't have the COBRA cost, you know, because then you go on short-term, they're paying the health insurance cost until you can get back. And usually that's for about 6 months, okay, which should cover you for the waiting initial application and the reconsideration level, okay? If you haven't gotten it by that point, then you can move to long-term disability. You can flip it over into long-term disability after about 24 weeks. And after we see whether you've gotten into waiting initial, if you've been granted a waiting initial level, new initial application level, or the reconsideration level, you can go into long-term disability, which means you have a disability check coming in, and they may still then be paying for your health insurance premium for a certain period of time while you're on the LTD also. So you need to ask some questions at work. You need to ask some questions about, talk about HR, you need to ask about the COBRA, which is you're not working at all, you just terminate, and you're paying your own insurance premium. You need to ask what the short-term disability policy looks like and what health coverages are on that. If you have to flip that 24 weeks later, however many months later that you're covered under, you have to flip that into an LTD thing, what that's going to look like, what your disability check is going to look like, and also who's paying your health insurance during that time too. Okay?
I was
going to
potentially look at if there's insurance options if you're
taking
this job as well. If any get covered that way.
But the best of all worlds is to have some kind of check coming in, your health insurance coming in, and you being taking care of your own self, going to the doctor, taking care of yourself, you know, staying at home. That basically becomes your job at that point. and apply, and apply at the same time, simultaneously.
On the Social Security, who pays for your medicine once you're on Social Security? Who pays that?
On Social Security disability, once you, that's a very good question, once you win Social Security disability benefits, and assuming you don't qualify for SSI because you have too much money, I mean, typically somebody who would have a working spouse, that working spouse is going to be making too much money for them to qualify for SSI, in which case you get Medicaid along with it. So we're assuming, just putting that aside, you probably wouldn't qualify for that. What happens is that once you get SSD, if they say, okay, you went on short-term disability today, which is January, what, the 19th? Okay. What did I say? Or I think in January. I'll think in the future. December 19th, okay. All right, if you were found disabled today, you applied today, they said, okay, darn it, you're disabled today. All right. Then 2 years and 5 months from today, okay, you're gonna be eligible in getting Medicare. Okay, at that point. So there's a 2 year and 5 month period for that to kick in, which is why Alicia's point is good, because on your LTD, health insurance benefit may not last forever. Your STD and LTD may not last that long, and certainly even for COBRA, there's a 24-month or 18 to 24-month period even on that. So, but then you have this 2 year and 5 month kick in for Medicare. Okay, once it does kick in, okay, you are getting the Part A, does basic hospitalization, major medical, and stuff like that. Then you can get the Part B, which is doctors and other practitioners and things like that. Then you can get a Part D, which is a drug plan, medicine and drug plan as well. So basically, I think you get Part A just thrown in with the package. That's a freebie. You get it. Yeah, and they charge you a little premium for that. It's not completely free, but they charge you a premium for it, which is $50, $75, $80, something like that. It's very inexpensive for what it covers. but then it's recommended for yourself, especially if you have an ongoing matter you're dealing with, to get the Part B and also the Part D. And I always get my ABCs mixed up, so all I'm saying is that Part A ain't enough. You need to also look into the Part B and the Part D when the time comes. But you're eligible just in terms of your timeline. You have to figure out what your health insurance is going to last you to make that last into 2 years and 5 months from the day, not from your application, but from the day that Social Security disability finds you disabled.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would it be for the entire family? Would the family have insurance?
No. No, it's only going to... Yeah, Medicare is only going to cover you. Yeah. Well, they'll just be carried as dependents on his insurance at work. Hopefully, his work will has health insurance. And the question was, will Medicare cover the family of the disabled worker? And unfortunately, the Medicare only covers the disabled worker. Yeah. So, any other questions before I turn to the telephone audience? Any other? So how do I? I'm asking Alicia now for the telephone. I'm going to ask her, how do I turn to
Sarah? Yeah. Can we go ahead and open the other lines to see if anybody has any questions?
Sure. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please press 7 on your touch-tone keypad. And our first question comes from Susan. Susan, your line is open.
Hello? I have my daughter. She dentals with MS. She's 20 years old. She never worked. And I applied for Social Security SSI and they denied her. And what should I do?
Okay, the question is, this is Victor McCreese. How you doing? The question is, you have a 20-year-old daughter?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and she has MS?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and you applied Social Security for her, but she was denied?
Yeah, I applied in September.
Okay. Did they say why they denied her, out of curiosity? Did they say she didn't have enough credits, or they didn't believe she was ill enough, or what was the deal there?
They showed them a letter because we have the MS on control, because we started with treatments.
Okay. So they're saying that she's got MS, but basically she's not ill enough with the MS for her to be found disabled. Is that correct?
Well, it says in the letter because she's not feel that sick enough because we have the sickness on control because you've been treated with medication.
Okay, I got it. Let me just tell you one thing by way of observation that I've had people come into my office that were, I can't, there's no other way I can think about saying it, sick as a dog with diabetes. I mean, they were bad, bad, really bad. 62 years old, in their 60s, really sick. Half of their foot was cut off because of diabetes. They're walking with a stub. I mean, really bad shape. I've also had people that walk in my office with four strokes on a walker that have been denied as well. So what I'm telling you is what I said before, and the rules are appeal, 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 and appeal. You got to appeal that. So if you applied in September, I assume that you were that your daughter was denied sometime in the last 60 days. She's got 60 days from the date that she was denied to appeal. If you're beyond that period of time, I encourage you to reapply for your daughter. And if you'd like that, we can, of course, help you with that. If you'd like to call us Monday.
How should I reapply again? Like get more letters from the doctor or what?
Well, there is a maybe the correct information, maybe enough information was not received. And, you know, Social Security does a pretty good job of ordering records, but it's not unusual for you to provide seven or eight different medical providers who will only order from four and then try to make a decision based on those four. So it could be that they did not get everything that they should have gotten. But the idea is to appeal the current denial, then determine either by asking the branch office that's handling it or whoever is in charge of the file, if it's with the DDS, what records do they have? And if they're lacking some records that are very important that of medical providers that your daughter has seen, then those records then can be obtained by yourself or your daughter and submitted. Additionally, there is a residual functional capacity form that the doctor can fill out. These are forms that we generally have at our office that we give to clients to take to their doctors on their next visit to fill out. And these forms basically, you can basically ask the doctor to write a letter as to how many hours per day your daughter can stand, how many she can sit, how much weight she can work with all day long. Is that weight 5 pounds, 10 pounds, 20 pounds? Does she have any physical limitations like working with her fingers, working with her hands, working with her wrists, working with her legs? Whatever those physical limitations are, and put it together in a letter and accompany those submitted records when you're resubmitting whatever records that they're lacking at the same time. A good letter like that, or a good filled out form, whatever that doctor's going to be filling out, that basically talks about the functional limitations that your daughter would have at a workplace, accompanied by a longitudinal record, like a history of her seeing the same doctor and the doctor seeing her and checking her over time over many, many visits. Really is a very good proof in a disability case.
All right, see, like she was diagnosed like in the 5th month or the 6th month, but she used to live up in Boston, and that's where she'd been diagnosed at. Then she came home into September, and Dr. George Hudson is the one who took all the records from there, and he diagnosed her with MS also.
Okay.
So Dr. Hudson haven't done new records, because I don't have no medical card,
okay.
for extra MRI, but this medication, they're helping me so far. They give the medication to her, the injection.
Right, right.
And I'm scared about that too,
Right. So you're saying that she just may have been diagnosed just now, or?
Like around 5 or 6 months ago.
Okay. And it sounds like they are just now talking about giving her some pretty invasive treatment, and she hasn't really gotten into that very much?
Yeah, she got into the Rebic injection.
Okay. All right.
Another 6 months from now, I have to get another MRI to see if that medication works with her or not.
Right. I think your strategy, ma'am, is really going to be for your daughter to appeal the current denial and continue treating. Then over time, you know, over time, keep getting updates on her records from the last date y'all had records and keep submitting those. For example, if the current, they currently have records through September the 30th, then appeal what you got now, appeal it to the next level, and then 6 months from now, you know, get the last 6 months worth of records and then submit those. And so basically what we do our client is going through the appeal process, we are getting updates on the records from the last date that that they went to the doctor, from the last date that we have records from that particular doctor for. And we just keep submitting until at the time of hearing, we do a last sweep of everything to make sure we picked up any last records. And so by the time we go to hearing, the complete medical records are there. So I think really it's going to be a duality. She's going to continue to be treated, continue seeking her treatment, continue seeing your doctors while you're appealing.
All right. So you think that's the best thing for me to do, get that letter you were telling me the doctor to fill it out and reply again?
Right. And if she's just now been denied, now would be an excellent time to get a letter from the doctor indicating what her physical limitations are in terms of working at a workplace, standing, sitting, walking, stooping, bending, lifting weights, and things like that. And then submit that together with your appeal, even as she's continuing to treat.
It don't matter because she never worked before or anything like that.
Well, it sounds to me if she's never worked before, let me ask you this, are you getting a Social Security check?
Nothing on her.
No, I mean, are you getting one?
No.
Okay. If either you or her biological father, her father, was getting a Social Security check, then she could apply as an adult disabled child and apply for Social Security. If that's not the case, and if she herself has not enough work credits, if she's never worked herself, then she can apply for SSI, which it sounds to me probably the kind of application that you have at this point. It's probably an SSI application. That's for folks who have never worked.
You in Houston, right?
Yes, ma'am.
I could come up there and pick up that letter, and I could show you the papers I have and stuff. That'll be okay?
Where do you live?
I live in Houston.
Oh, fine. Yeah, if you wanted to come by the office, we'd be happy to provide that to you. Sure.
Well, we could do that because her doctor won't be back in on the 28th of this month after the holidays.
Okay. Yeah, I'd be happy to provide that to you. And if you want to bring your daughter in, we'd be happy to talk to her as well. No problem.
I appreciate that, my friend.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Remember, just keep the case alive. You have to keep appealing. That's the main thing.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
There are currently no questions on the audio side.
Okay. No further questions from the telephone audience.
If you'd like to ask a question, please press 7. Our next question comes from Carol.
Hi. Thank you very much for the time you're spending with us. I'm kind of just at a curiosity and planning perspective. My name is Carol Rosa. I lost my job last summer. I have always, thankfully, my MS is such that I have always been able to work a 40-hour job with carrying a pager and all those things you do on weekends or at night, and it hasn't, my MS hasn't interrupted my work life. However, since I have been unemployed, which is August 1st, I have been participating in a lot of the MS work-life programs to help me physically because I am motor disabled, as in I'm very, very, very slow. In my walking, I use a cane or a walker. And I don't type with 10 fingers anymore. I only type with 8 fingers. And I have been torn, and mostly at the suggestions of my financial planner, Carol, the best thing you could do is get back to work, and you might investigate your Social Security options. And so I am working my 40-hour a week besides working with my MS aerobics people or in the gym with my MS friends. I am working on looking for a job. And I go between this decision, do I really want to go back to work? Don't I want to go back to work?